You can be opening your Bibles to Acts 14, and we'll be there in just a moment. Just so everybody's aware, next Sunday, Levi, Gabriel, and Dan will be in Indio. And so we're going to be out of town, and I think there's been arrangements made for whoever's going to be while I'm gone. So anyways, that'll be it'll be exciting for us to be up in Indio, and I'm sure you guys will get some good lessons from some other folks. By the way, I just want to let everybody know that hey, Gregor, can you turn on this mic, and I'm just going to turn this one off. We'll do it that way. Is this on now? All right, so anyways, every Sunday night at 4:30, Steve Lorenz is going through new songs with us. And so I'd encourage people, if they can make it, to come to that, because what Steve is doing is we're just going through new songs, and if anybody has any questions about the song we're singing, we'll just kind of pause it as we're going through it and just answer any questions that we might have about it. And so hopefully we're going to be able to introduce some of those songs into our regular worship. So if you get caught off guard if we sing a new song, it's your fault because you didn't come on Sunday nights. That's kind of a joke, but be here is what I'm saying, if you can. All right, so Acts chapter 14. I want to start this lesson with a trivia question. Of all the letters that the Apostle Paul wrote, which of his letters was the sternest in tone? If you know your New Testament and you've been a student of the Bible, you'd know immediately that that letter would be the letter to the Galatians. This was a letter that Paul wrote to these people who were quickly deserting the things that they had been taught. And when we get to Acts chapter 14 in our studies in the book of Acts, we're seeing Paul in that very region, where he's reaching out to these people. So one of the interesting things about the book of Acts is that it gives us the history, and then the letters of the New Testament show us those groups of churches that he's writing to and things of that nature. So in Acts chapter 14, when he's in this Galatian region, Paul's going to visit three cities, Iconium, Lystra, and Derbe. And in the first city, there's going to be a synagogue, which would have meant that there is a lot of Jews there. In the second two cities, there is no synagogue. So Paul's going in this chapter to some very heavily pagan-oriented kinds of cultures. And so there'll be some interesting things to say about how he reaches out to those folks. This chapter can be structured under these two headings. Verses 1 through 20 shows Paul doing some evangelism, and then verses 21 to 28 shows him doing some encouragement to the churches that he had established. Before we start reading from this chapter, though, I want us to go to the end of the chapter and look at verse 27. Notice how this chapter ends. When Paul goes back to his home base in Antioch, it says, "And when they arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God had done with them and how he opened a door of faith to the Gentiles." Now, we're going to see the context of all of this in a moment, but try to think about how this verse helps shape the rest of the chapter. Paul goes to his home church at Antioch, and he tells them that the door of faith has been opened to the Gentiles. Now, what does he mean by that? Does he mean that God's opened up a door for him to reach the Gentiles? Or does he mean that the Gentiles have had a door opened to them where they can come into a relationship with God? I think it would be both. Now, just stop for a moment and think about the idea of an open door. Have you heard religious folks say, "God opened up a door for me to do X, Y, or Z"? And you ask them, "Well, how do you know that God opened up the door?" And a lot of the times people will say, "Well, it was just really easy, and it was right there in front of me, and God made everything super convenient for me." That's how a lot of people think about that kind of idea. When we look at Acts 14, an open door for Paul is not easy. It's filled with hardships, but he still has to go through it. So before we read chapter 14 and parts of it, let's just give us a little reminder of some of the things that we've seen. We remember with the first evangelism trip that he leaves from Antioch, and then he goes to this island of Cyprus where he reaches Sergius Paulus. They go to Perga, and that's where John Mark leaves at that point. And then they go up through the Taurus Mountain to Pisidian Antioch, where Paul preaches his longest recorded sermon. We saw that last week. In this lesson tonight, we're going to see him, first of all, going to Iconium. So let's go ahead and read verses 1 through 7. Now at Iconium, they entered together into the Jewish synagogue and spoke in such a way that a great number of both Jews and Greeks believed. But the unbelieving Jews stirred up the Gentiles and poisoned their minds against the brothers. So they remained for a long time speaking boldly for the Lord, who bore witness to the word of his grace, granting signs and wonders be done by their hands. But the people of the city were divided. Some sided with the Jews and some with the apostles. When an attempt was made by both Gentiles and Jews with their rulers to mistreat them and to stone them, they learned of it and fled to Lystra and Derbe, cities of Lycaonia, and to the surrounding country. And there they continued to preach the gospel. Now, notice in this text in verse 1 that it says that Paul and Barnabas spoke in such a way that many people believed. There's a couple things just to note about that. Why were there so many people coming to a knowledge of God? Was it because they had some kind of emotional religious experience? It was because in this text, Paul was speaking to them. Throughout the book of Acts, the reason anybody ever becomes a believer is because they heard the message proclaimed to them. Your faith grows by the word of God. But what does it mean in this text when it says Paul spoke in such a way that many believed? And as a preacher, like, I want to know what that means. With some of the people that you're trying to reach, that you know, you want to know what that means too. I think Paul explains it best in 1 Corinthians 2 when he says how he came to Corinth. When he came to Corinth, he came without bringing human lofty wisdom or reasoning, and the only thing he knew among them was Christ and him crucified. What does it mean to speak in such a way that many people believe? It means that you're living out the message that you're preaching, but it means that in your speaking, you're emphasizing God and not yourself. You're getting yourself out of the message. So Paul's preaching to all of these people, and if you look at verse 3, the text says that God was bearing witness through signs and miracles. Have you ever thought about the wording of phrases like that in the book of Acts? God was bearing witness. Who bears witness? People who are on the witness stand in court, bear witness. So it's like you've got God in the book of Acts, and he's on the witness stand, and he's continually testifying and bearing witness to the truth of the teaching by allowing miracles to happen. And look at verse 4. These people who are proclaiming the message, this might be troubling at first, but you see that Paul and Barnabas are both called apostles here. Why are they both called apostles? In verse 14, they're also called apostles in this text. God had the original 12 apostles, and we know that Barnabas wasn't one of those 12. In a sense, Paul wasn't one of those original 12. So what does it mean that they're apostles? That one sent out, and so these people were sent out by the church in Antioch, but this doesn't mean that they were one of the original 12. It's interesting when you look at this first little vignette that's given to us, the kind of opposition that happens to their preaching. So you imagine Paul and Barnabas go to this area. There's a Jewish synagogue there. A bunch of people are getting converted. There's two ways in which opposition happens in this text. The first way is through the poisoning of the mind. Did you know that your mind could get poisoned? Isn't that kind of a scary thought? Like, if you drink poison, it gets into your bloodstream and it affects everything until your heart stops and you die. This is saying that your mind can get poisoned. Have you ever had a time before where you were trying to help somebody who didn't know the Lord to know some things about God? And then you meet with them the next week and they say, well, this person's been talking to me, my friend's been talking to me, and they've been explaining to me that everything that you've been telling me is not right for whatever reason. It seems to always happen that when you're trying to help somebody come to know God, somebody's going to come around and poison their minds. But what's the second kind of opposition that happens in this text? Paul and Barnabas, as they get into the city polarizes over the teaching, and the Jews work with some of the Gentile leaders to try to get Paul stoned. Paul learns about that, and what does he do? He flees to the next towns, which is interesting to me. Proverbs 22, verse 3, the prudent sees danger and hides himself, but the simple go on and suffer for it. There's a preacher that I've heard at times, and he always says this, and I don't know why, but he always makes this point. He always says, I want to die on the mission field. I want to seek out to die that way. When you see Paul in the book of Acts, if he knew that he was going to be killed, did he flee from it? Yeah. In the next city, he will be stoned. So if he doesn't have a choice, he's going to have to go through it. But when he has the ability to flee from persecution, he does it all throughout the book of Acts. So that's where he's in Iconium. But look at when he goes to Lystra here. This is an interesting thing that happens in this town. Look at verses 8 to 20. Now at Lystra, there was a man sitting who could not use his feet. He was crippled from birth and had never walked. Notice how much it emphasizes he had never walked in three different ways. Verse 9, he listened to Paul speaking, and Paul, looking intently at him, seeing that he had faith to be made well, said in a loud voice, stand upright on your feet. And he sprang up and began walking. And when the crowd saw what Paul had done, they lifted up their voices, saying in Lycaonian, the gods have come down to us in the likeness of men. Barnabas they called Zeus, and Paul Hermes, because he was the chief speaker. And the priest of Zeus, whose temple was at the entrance of the city, brought oxen and garlands to the gates and wanted to offer sacrifice with the crowds. But when the apostles Barnabas and Paul heard of it, they tore their garments and rushed out of the crowd, crying out, men, why are you doing these things? We also are men of like nature with you, and we bring you good news that you should turn from these vain things to a living God who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and all that is in them. In the past generations, he allowed all the nations to walk in their own way, yet he did not leave himself without witness. For he did good by giving you rains from heaven and fruitful seasons, satisfying your hearts with food and gladness. Even with these words, they scarcely restrained the people from offering sacrifices to them. But Jews from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded, they came from Antioch and Iconium, and having persuaded the crowds, they stoned Paul and dragged him out of the city, supposing that he was dead. But when the apostles gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city, and on the next day he went on with Barnabas to Derbe. You notice what happens here is Paul strolls into the city of Lystra. When he comes into the city, we don't see any record of him going to a synagogue, which would have meant that there was a low Jewish population. So it seems like here he's kind of doing open-air preaching. And you've got this man who, again in verse 9, is just emphasized in so many different ways that he had never walked before, or in verse 8. Imagine this man sitting there. What do you think his legs look like? Like, they would have been like little twigs that would have just been like scrunched up together. And Paul's preaching about the gospel and Jesus and all the things that he has to give people by offering forgiveness of sins. And this guy's listening to everything that the apostle Paul is saying. And Paul can tell by the look on this guy's face that he has faith. And so notice in verse 10 that it says, Paul said in a loud voice. Why does Paul say in such a loud voice for this man to stand up? Again, the purpose of miracles is to confirm the word, and if Paul can say this loudly, it shows everybody that the things he just spoke about in his sermon have real power. And by the way, does this guy who's being told to stand up have the power to do that in and of himself? No. Have you ever felt like before that God's given you a command that you can't fulfill on your own strength? That's pretty much all of them, right? Whenever God gives us a command, he also gives us the strength to fulfill it. So this guy starts to stand up. Can you imagine that? Everybody in this town would have known that this guy was lame, and now he's finally standing. But what do the people in the city do? In verse 12, the people in the city have the wrong response to it, and they're saying in their Lycaonian language, the gods have come down in the likeness of men. And they assume that Barnabas is Zeus, the chief god, and they assume that Paul is Hermes, who's the spokesperson of the gods. I don't know if you know some of the history behind this, but in this region, in the ancient world, there's a myth that two gods came into human flesh, and they dwelt among this area for a while. And there was only an old couple that showed them hospitality, these two gods. And so these two gods, like, judged the rest of the region, but the two people that housed them and showed them hospitality were made into the priests of that god. And so you can imagine if these people still believed in a myth like that, if you've got somebody doing a miracle, they would be frightened to death that that would ever happen again. So imagine this crowd. They come up to Paul and Barnabas, and they have wreaths. And if you read ancient writers, they'll say all kinds of interesting things on what these kinds of ceremonies would have looked like. There would have been a big procession leading to the temple of Zeus, and there would have been somebody carrying a basket that had a big knife in it. And the bull or the oxen, whatever it was that they were going to sacrifice, would have been in the front. And everybody would have been chanting and doing all of these barbaric sorts of things. When they got to the temple, they would make the sacrifice. And in this context, they're wanting to do all of this in the name of Paul. Can you imagine what Paul would have felt about that? Paul and Barnabas tear their garments as a way of expressing deep mourning and grief over what they're doing. And with their torn garments, they're going to start to address the crowd. Now, verses 15 to 17 is a very unique part of the scripture. In Acts 17, we have Paul addressing in deeper length pagans who don't know the Bible. In Acts 13, Paul preached to people who knew the Old Testament, and he used the Old Testament. Here, Paul's preaching to people who do not know the Bible. And he's not going to quote from the Bible. He's going to start with where they're at and reason with them from where they are. Paul doesn't have the same approach with every single person that he talks to. So think about the approach that he takes with these people in verses 15 to 17. He, with his torn garments, the first thing he says to these people is, look, don't do this. We have the same nature as you. Why is that important? How many false religions have been started because somebody said, I'm God? Or somebody said, there's something very unique about me, and you need to listen to all the things that have been revealed to me. Here, Paul and Barnabas are saying, hey, we're just like you. We don't deserve this kind of recognition. That's the first thing he says. But if you go further down in the address that he gives them, he says to them, he encourages them to turn from these vain things. The word vain means worthless and empty and ineffective. What's he talking about? What's vain? This whole procession. All of this stuff that you guys are doing to try to venerate me and I'm just a man. And this worship to Zeus, this worship to Hermes, all of this kind of pagan ideas, all of these things are worthless and they will not give you what you want. In the ancient world, this is how paganism worked. If you were a soldier, you sacrificed to the god of war because you wanted him on your side. If you were a farmer, you sacrificed to the god who gave rain. If you sold in the marketplaces, you would worship the god that would help you in the marketplaces, whatever god that was. And so here Paul's saying, all of these gods that you've decided to follow, that you think are going to give you everything that you've ever wanted, all of these things are worthless and meaningless. By the way, can we learn a lesson from that in how we talk to people who don't know the Bible? You're trying to be fulfilled by sports? You think that's really going to do it? Because your body's going to get old and you won't be able to do this your whole life. Then you're going to be depressed. You're trying to be fulfilled by your beauty or your strength? Well, you get older and your body doesn't look the same as it used to. You're trying to be fulfilled by your career? Problems happen where the stock market crashes. Things you're trying to find fulfillment in are vain and they'll leave you empty and they'll never be able to give you what you want. But he doesn't just say what not to do. He gives the alternative by saying that there is a God who's not vain. And in verse 15, Paul says that this God created the heavens and the earth. And for many years, God allowed these pagans to live in their paganism. That doesn't mean that he was okay with their sin. It just means he didn't send a blazing judgment on them. But now he's calling all of these people to repent. And he's explaining to them from nature, God every season has given you rains. God every season, even though you guys are pagans, has blessed you. Is there a lesson in that? Does God bless people who hate him? He sends the rain on the just and the unjust, right? What can you say to somebody who doesn't know a thing about the Bible and hates God? Look at what God's done for you. Look at the car you have. Look at the family you have. Look at the house that you have. Look at the nation that you live in. Look at the family that you came from. And maybe you learned some bad things from them, but it wasn't all bad. Look at the blessings you've already been given. Do you know why you have those things? It's because there's a God of order who sends the rain when the rain should come. There's a God of order that you can just look out at space and see from looking at creation that there is a God. That's how Paul reaches these people or tries to reach these people. Now, all of those things will be expanded in Acts 17, so stay tuned for that one. But look how the crowd responds to this. As Paul is preaching all of these things to them, it says that they could just barely restrain them from still worshiping. Can you imagine what that conversation looked like? Paul's saying, don't worship us, don't worship us. And the people are saying, no, we will, no, we will. Okay, all right, we won't, we won't. And they eventually relent. But here comes some of the Jews from Iconium. And just like they were poisoning the minds of the people there, they start to poison the minds of the people in Lystra. Have you ever had somebody quickly change their mind about you? On one day they're saying you're great, you're awesome, the greatest thing ever, and then the next day they're saying all kinds of mean things about you. That's what happens with Paul here. All these people first want to worship him, and then they get deceived by the Jewish people that they should start chucking stones at him. Imagine what that looked like. Paul and Barnabas are seized, or at least Paul is for sure. And when people would get stoned back then, the stones would be pretty big, like maybe the size of a football. And they would start chucking him at people. I don't know if he broke a rib. I imagine that his nose was bleeding. He had bruises all over his face. And then he gets drug out of the city and left for dead. Look at verse 20 again. In verse 20, but when the disciples gathered about him, he rose up and entered the city. On the next day, he went on with Barnabas to Derbe. Isn't that verse amazing? That verse is amazing for a couple of reasons to me. First of all, the disciples gather around him. Why does that matter? If you gather around this guy that everybody just thought deserved death, you're siding with him. And these seem like they're new Christians. And they're already willing to make that kind of sacrifice. But as they're all surrounding him, I don't know if they were praying for him, but eventually Paul starts blinking again and he gets animated again. And he doesn't go to the next town. He goes straight back to Lystra. Would you want to do that? The same town that just stoned you? One of the things that's interesting, again, about the book of Acts is that when we study this book, it fills in a lot of interesting things that he wrote in some of his letters. In 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 25, Paul says, 3 times I was beaten with rods, 1 I was stoned, 3 I was shipwrecked. How many times was Paul stoned? Just once. And it was right here. This was a monumental moment in his mind because this was perhaps the severest persecution he ever experienced. And later when he writes to the church in Galatia, he says this in Galatians 6:17, from now on, let no one cause me trouble, for I bear on my body the marks of Jesus. What would those marks have been? Probably the marks from the stonings and the beatings. And all of these marks happened in this very area. Now, after Paul experiences this, he goes to Derbe, and he's going to preach in that area, and we'll talk more about that in just a moment. But this gets us into verses 21 to 28, to his return home. Look at verses 21 to 28. When they had preached the gospel to that city and had made many disciples, they returned to Lystra and to Iconium and to Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples, encouraging them to continue in the faith, and saying that through many tribulations we must enter the kingdom of God. And when they had appointed elders for them in every church with prayer and fasting, they committed them to the Lord in whom they had believed. Then they passed through Pisidia and came to Pamphylia. And when they had spoken the word in Perga, they went down to Attalia. And from there they sailed to Antioch, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work that they had fulfilled. And when they had arrived and gathered the church together, they declared all that God had done with them and how he had opened a door of faith to the Gentiles. And they remained no little time with the disciples. All right, try to think about this journey that Paul goes on. There's a ton of cities that are named here. But look at how close Paul is to Antioch right here on the map. This is his home base. This is where he is. You would think Paul would just go, whoop, right around here. That's not what he does. Instead, he backtracks from Derbe to Iconium. That's around 40 or 50 miles, and then 20 miles back to Lystra, and then all the way back to Antioch, and then 100 miles down the Taurus mountain range. He goes through all of these different areas. Why does he go out of his way? And let me ask you this question. What reasons do you go out of your way? What are the reasons you go out of your way throughout the week? If it's a good restaurant, I'll go out of my way for it. I go out of my way for things that matter to me. Here, Paul's going out of his way for several different reasons. Here's the first reason. And this goes back to verse 20, end of verse 25. Paul's going to preach again in cities that I don't think he was able to preach in yet. In verse 20, he preaches in Derbe, but in verse 25, he's preaching in Perga. Do you remember what happened in Perga? This is where John Mark left in Acts 13. My assumption, and I might be wrong about this, but my guess is that when Mark left, it created such a scuffle that Paul didn't even have time to preach there. So he wants to go back to this area and make sure that he preaches. We don't get any records of the conversions. We don't get any records of the kind of people who came to know God. But one of the reasons he's going out of his way is to make sure he preaches in certain cities that he didn't get on the way there, I think. But here's another reason, in verse 22. To strengthen the churches that he's already established. Paul revisits some of these churches that he already communicated with, and it says that he's strengthening and encouraging them, but what's he saying to them that strengthens and encourages them? Through many tribulations, we will enter the kingdom. That sound encouraging to you? And here's Paul, he's coming back to these cities with all of these marks on his body, and he's living evidence that if you want to be in the kingdom, one of the things that you will have to experience is persecution and tribulation. Why would that ever encourage any church? Can you imagine if some dude came up to the front here, and he lived in Santee, and he said, guess what happened to me last night? I was trying to preach the gospel to some people, and they all started whipping me and stoning me and punching me in the face, and look at all my bruises. How many of us would be encouraged by that? I'd be intimidated. But why is this strengthening to the churches? The day I got baptized, I thought that my family was going to be really supportive. And I thought all of my friends at work and all my friends from high school would really be like, Eric, that's great. I'm glad that you're making a turn in your life. But the day that I got baptized, all kinds of things happened with my family. Before I got baptized, Andy Cantrell had me read Luke 14, where Jesus says, you cannot be my disciple unless you hate your father, mother, sister, brother, wife, even your own life. You can't be my disciple unless you renounce all of your possessions. And there's a third one, but I don't remember the other one right now. But he said to me, Eric, you're about to get baptized, and there's going to be some people that think you're really strange for doing what you just did. Now, for me, what that did is that strengthened me because it set my expectations in the right place. Can you imagine if Paul had told all of these people, your life's going to go great in the Lord? Then when things start to crumble all around them, are they strengthened? Are they ready for it? They're not. There's a need for us to strengthen new believers. Paul here is revisiting all of these people that are recent converts, and he's spending time with them and reaching out to them because new converts need that kind of attention. The second reason why he went there is to strengthen churches, but here's the third reason in verse 23, to appoint elders in the churches, which is interesting to me because these are new Christians. How can he already be appointing elders? I don't have all the reasons or all the answers to that, but maybe some of these folks grew up as Jews, and they already had a lot of background knowledge in the Bible, and therefore their character was being honed, and they could be elders quicker. I don't know how all of that worked. But notice a couple observations from this. It says in verse 23 that Paul appointed elders in every church. Do you see Big Daddy Church overseeing all the other churches? Each local church was autonomous. Each local church had its own leadership. But notice something else about this. Every local church had multiple elders. There wasn't just one guy ruling the whole church. And those are points that many of us are familiar with, but it's important to see that. Now, look at verse 28, the last verse in this chapter. It says, when they had gone back to Antioch, they remained no little time with the disciples. Paul returns from his mission, from his evangelism trip, and he spends a long time with them, and he gives them an update on how the trip went. What do you think that was like when the beaten and battered and weathered Paul, after 2 years of evangelism, comes back to this church, and he looks very different than what he did before? What's he going to say to these people? In verse 26, he talks about the work that they fulfilled. I think it's interesting to just notice the word work. You know that being a Christian takes work? And serving the Lord the way that Paul served took work? What kind of work did Paul engage in when he was on this evangelism trip? Starting conversations with people that he had never met before. Being stoned, finding ships that he can ride on, having all kinds of persecution, the work of losing sleep at night for the Lord. Here's a question for all of us. Would we say that we're working for God? People who go through open doors are working. But look at verse 27. In verse 27, it says that Paul declared all that had happened. That means the things that happened in Derbe, the things that happened in Perga, Paul would have explained all of those stories. Can you imagine how encouraging that would have been to the whole church? This church helped support Paul in that work that he did. And now Paul's saying, because of you guys' support, and you laid hands on us and encouraged us in the work, you've all indirectly participated in that. But notice, perhaps most importantly in verse 27, Paul wasn't declaring all the things that he did. He was declaring all the things that God had done through them. That God had opened up a door to the Gentiles, and he had been given that door, and he went through it. Here's the encouragement in all of this. That whatever work you're doing for the Lord, whatever gift you have for the Lord and you're using it, it's going to take work. But do you know who's working alongside with you? Do you know who your coworker is? It's Jesus. It's God. And if he's the one that's working with us, he will give increase where he wants to. But being a disciple of God takes discipleship, and it takes hardship and danger sometimes. And when I look at chapters like this, it just shames me, because those aren't the kinds of things that I always go through. If you're here tonight and you've been convinced that you need to become a Christian, or you realize that your service to God is not where it ought to be, this is an opportunity for you to repent. This is an opportunity for you to put on Christ in baptism. If there's anything we can do for you, we're going to sing song number 319.